Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. And today's show is going to be a little different in a potentially narcissistic but hopefully entertaining way. Our guest today is going to be myself. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, me, Eric Davis, will be the guest on Expanding Mind. Luckily, however, we have a co-host here in Expanding Mind, so it's not just going to be me rattling on the whole time, but we are here to talk about my new collection. It's called Nomad Codes, Adventures in Modern Esoterica, and it's just been published by Yeti Press, and yes, it is in a physical form. Trees were sacrificed for the production of this particular object, but we'll get to that. So I think without further ado, we'll bring on our co-host, Maja Daou, who has gratefully agreed to interview, that's right, me, here on Expanding Mind, and to talk about the book, which collects essays, articles, odd thoughts, blog posts, etc., that I have been producing for, oh my God, over 20 years now as a freelance writer, author guy. I'm pretty proud of it, and I'm glad that Maja was willing to talk to me about it here on Expanding Minds. So, Maja, hi, how's it going?
It's going good. It's my pleasure to talk about your book, Eric. It's very exciting.
Yeah, and just to say also that Maja and I will be talking and I will be reading from the book in Los Angeles next week on November 9th at the Annie Besant Hall, and I will also be doing a reading at City Lights in San Francisco on December 7th, Tuesday of next week. So if you're in those areas, you might want to check it out. But anyway, I'm going to hand it over to you, Maja. You're the interviewer today.
All right. I totally get to interview you. I have your book in my hot little hand here. I've been reading it. I had read a lot of your articles that are in here on the internet, and I thought it's so interesting because, like you said, a lot of these are from, you know, all kinds of different sources, like from internet written material. Some of them were published in journals. It's totally an amalgamation of all of these things, and it's pretty interesting that these kind of techno-style writings are amassed in an actual physical book. What do you think about that? Like, just all this kind of internet stuff that you've done put together in a physical object book like that. I think it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just, as I said, there are things in there from over 20 years. So most of it appeared in print in one form or the other, either in newsprint or magazines, or I think in one or two instances a book, but then a lot of the more recent writings have been, if not published online, then at least widely circulated online. And it was funny when the guys from Yeti Press approached me and they said they wanted to put out a collection. You know, I was very flattered. They had done a previous one with Luc Santé, who's one of my favorite, you know, contemporary culture critics and writers. He's a marvelous author, and so when they came to me, I was like, hey, that's pretty good company, and I thought, hey, why not check it out, see what it's like to put all this stuff together. And it was interesting. What I found is that by putting all this sort of disparate material together, writings about rock music, writings about technology, about esotericism, about psychedelics, about Philip K. Dick, about, you know, other literature, I thought of these things as kind of ragtag collection, but when I put them all together in a book, there's something about the way the book creates the opportunity for a kind of dialogue or a kind of resonating depth between the things inside of it kinds of interconnections that you don't really see online.
Well, that's what I thought was really neat, is that it does. It actually makes like a stream, which is, I mean, it's kind of amazing that it's over so long a period of time, and it's these things that were kind of floating everywhere, like you said, over this, you know, raggle-taggle different amount of subjects, and yet it's this, like, crystallization of years of your life on all these different subjects that actually do condense into one spot in a kind of stream. And I think that just kind of speaks to this like weird trail that your consciousness has gone on over the years, you know?
Well, what it's made me realize is that there's a real difference between, you know, I guess what we would call today content and maybe attitude or spirit. Because what came clear to me, and it's also true of my books, like the books I've written are all very different. You know, I write this sort of heady book about technology that's got a lot of intellectual stuff in it and media theory, and then I wrote this book about Led Zeppelin IV, and that was kind of a lark, and it's funny, and it's really obsessive in a rock critic kind of way, and then I wrote this book about alternative religion in California that's all about architecture and hippies, and on the surface, these things don't really resemble. They don't even look the same. And, you know, I'm a publicist nightmare because they're like, "What are you?" You know, or an agent. Agents like authors who just do kind of the same thing. You know, you do the Tipping Point, and then you do Blink, and then you know, it's like you get right. your shtick down, and then you just kind of vary it, and that's what they like. And I don't do that at all. But on the other hand, if you dig down, there's something really similar motivating a lot of these different projects, and and it was really clear for me when I put the book together, there was something that's been driving me, that continues to drive me, that doesn't have to do with like, oh, I'm writing for magazines, or oh, I'm writing about rock music, or here I'm trying to be, you know, think about esoteric philosophy, and here, you know, it's not really about the thing, it's sort of about the, you know, the spirit of it.
Well, and that's what it is, amazing, because it's like, I mean, you were a freelance journalist, and a lot of this stuff comes from, like you said, like freelance journalism, where you're writing. Most people think if you're going to be a journalist and you write a freelance article, you write what they want about some subject that they want. But what comes through in your writing is your spirit. And even though you are doing these freelance articles that under most normal circumstances for normal folks would just be some, like, you know, kind of soulless, you know, piece trying to promote whatever it was that the magazine wanted you to promote. But instead, what happens in your articles, which is why they come together so nicely in the book, is that it's yourself coming through in these and under all of the subjects, whether it's like technology or music or, you know, any of those things. It's your voice and your soul coming through them, which I think is rare indeed.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, one is that a lot of the articles in there were the pieces that I wrote to make myself happy while I was also doing money work. There are some money work articles in there as well. I mean, just to give people a taste of what the golden days were like in freelance journalism, there's an article in there about going to India in 1994.
Yeah, that one's great.
To Goa and to, you know, to hunt down the source of raves, you know, and there was this incredibly intense psychedelic underground dance music scene in Goa that just about that time in the early to mid 90s was breaking out in the West to take the form that we now call psytrance, which was called Goa trance for a while. So it was a really remarkable time to visit a scene, and I love going to subcultures and getting into scenes and, you know, kind of being an anthropologist of these worlds. And it was, you know, totally fascinating. It was a really fun article to write. I really had to stretch myself. I was there for a while, and it was all paid for.
Well,
and then
the
I got paid for it on top of it.
You know,
it like,
it's more like Hunter S. Thompson style when you do it that way. You know, I mean, it is. Like, you're going in there and experiencing it as you, Eric Davis, the human being, the soul, and then you're, like, reporting on it through that venue, which to me, like, reminds me a lot of Hunter S. Thompson, especially, you know, obviously because there's so many references to parties and drugs and things like that, but the way that you report on those things, and that was for what, for your first article for Wired magazine?
No, that one was for Details, although it wound up getting published in another magazine because Details never ended up running it, even though they paid for
man.
It. So that's what I mean. Those were the days. Well, one of the things that I did, and because while with a piece like that and a couple other like subculture pieces that I wrote in the early 90s, I went to a Rainbow Gathering. I went to a Star Trek convention and hung out with the Klingons and, you know, that kind of stuff. That allows that sort of new journalism exploration where you kind of include yourself a little bit. I was never too narcissistic about it, but I would have it was more like my attitudes, the things that I noticed.
Your perceptions.
Yeah, rather than like my own trip, exactly. But what I mostly did that kind of along those lines was as a, you know, writing about culture, writing about records and bands and TV shows and books and philosophy and all the stuff that I wrote about a great deal in the early 90s, or, you know, from the late 80s to the late 90s when I was really cranking out a lot of cultural criticism. I mean, basically the way I would do is I would just write about what I liked.
Yeah.
So that if I wrote about what I liked, then I would be enthusiastic about it, so I would be more inspired to write something good. And then I was exploring something that I liked, so it was like, well, why do I like this? You know, what's interesting about that to me? So in a way, it was kind of a narcissistic operation, but what it ended up doing was producing a lot of really, I think, kind of, you know, interesting writing, or writing that people responded to, because it had that sort of extra flavor, or because it was coming from a very peculiar or particular point of view. I mean, I never really thought of myself as a critic. I mean, I knew people who were critics, and they would listen to everything, and they had kind of a sense, you know, and it was ultimately subjective because it's taste. But they had a very kind of rigorous sense about what things were cheesy and what things were innovative and what things were pretentious. And, you know, someone like Rob Christgau, who wrote for, you know, The Village Voice forever, where I did a lot of rock writing and a lot of my culture criticism. The Village Voice is the main place that I wrote for many years. And it was a wonderful place to be because there were people who took writing about culture extremely seriously, and they also took writing very seriously. It was There was a lot of very good writing there, and I learned a lot about how to write from working with a variety of editors at The Voice. But, you know, some of those guys were like real critics, and I always was kind of more like a thief. You know, I wanted to go in there and write about what interested me, but, oh, maybe it's a TV show. So it's like, oh, wait, so The X-Files came out, and I was like, great, I can write about, like, UFOs and conspiracy culture. It was less about whether or not The X-Files was a good show,
right?
Although I was one of the first people to write about it, and that was kind of fun. But it was more like I recognized that it was something that would, you know, enable me to, like, explore stuff that interested me in general.
Well, and part of what that does, really on a big level, is since you are, you know, a journalist and reporting this in media, what that does is it makes your job taking your, like, fetishized, strange, occult, weird interests, and then you're, like, shooting them directly into the mainstream consciousness, basically. And so that, like, it kind of gives, because you do that and you're not just a critic where you take, like, what's popularly out there and then do this, like, in-depth examination, you're, like, the opposite. You're finding what drives you and is interesting to you and exposing it to people, really.
Yeah, there was definitely a kind of wink-wink conspiratorial side of it that was very much helped by the time. I mean, we have yet to really sort of have that moment where we regurgitate the early 90s. I mean, it comes up a little bit, but it seems like we're still kind of interested in the 80s in some sense. But when that moment happens and it's properly done, I think we will recognize that, you know, from 1990 through the 95, 96, 97, even just, you know, till the real insane part of the internet boom,
right,
was a very fertile, very interesting, very weird time. I mean, I was thinking, for example, in 1990, like Twin Peaks was on TV.
Yep.
And Twin Peaks was very strange. And it wasn't just that, wow, there was a weird show on TV, how about that? Look, there's a lot of weird shows on TV now, big deal. It was that, partly because it was on broadcast television, not on, like, some obscure cable channel that, you know,
on
now...
On prime time.
What's that?
It was on prime time.
Yeah, it was on prime time. But it felt like reality itself was kind of shifting because everybody would watch it, but it was too weird to be on prime time. And it was as if things were kind of melting a little bit. And there was a quality of that in the early 90s that made it a really, really fun time to be writing about culture. So I could be at a place like the Village Voice and writing about esoteric stuff and writing about drugs and writing about conspiracies and esoteric religious groups. But it kind of fit because the times were sort of weird. It's very different situation now.
Yeah, you would have never been able to write these things in the 80s.
No.
It just wouldn't have happened. It was very time specific, you know, that this underwent because of, you know, like you said, what was happening around these places. And you then become this like archivist of those times and kind of what was going on in a very interesting way. And I mean, just looking through the book, like to me, I felt that archivism because, like, I was experiencing a lot of that at the time in the 90s. And I think when anyone reads through the book, it's like time traveling through your stories and re-experiencing these things in culture, like with the Sun City Girls story.
Yeah, the Sun City Girls was a particularly excellent story to do because they're, you know, this long-running, deeply esoteric, deeply strange, kind of frightening band. And, you know, yeah. They're sort of legendary in the underground because even in the context of the underground, they don't really fit. They're not part of any scene. And yet, you know, until the recent death of their drummer, they just doing it, you know, for 20 plus years. You know, it was an insane story. And I remember when I bought some of this the cassettes that they sold, and I think I bought them in, you know, 91 or 92 or something, and Alan says, I'm sure I got your letter. I keep everything. And, you know, it was this cassette that was like, you know, Tibet 666, and it had this weird, you know, cover on it, and the music was so exotic and psychedelic but sarcastic and crazy and, you know, not at all sort of like hippie music but sort of like punk rock, sort of like something else. And it was always in my mind as this, like, they were really doing what I was interested in, which is creating the sense of an esoteric underworld, the sense that there was another world hidden but overlapping this one. And that there were certain points in popular culture where you could tune in and you could get a sense of that other world. The same way, like, when you're a kid and you read, you know, fairy tale books, part of the reason those books are so interesting when you're a kid is it feels like it's real. Like, my God, there is this little world of, you know, rabbits that talk that are just at the edge of the garden or, you know, whatever it is. It's not that far away. And I always was attracted to things in popular culture that had that sense of a secret, of a hidden world. And a lot of the time it's just a trick or it's just a kind of performance. It's just a way of presenting the material. But with the Sun City Girls, these guys are really intense characters. And so I finally got to write about them after all this time, and I was able to send them some of my earlier articles so they saw that I was a fellow weirdo, and they were more accepting than they normally would have been. And it really changed my world. I mean, even in terms of the book, you know, the piece that follows the Sun City Girls profile, which is definitely one of my favorite music profiles that I ever wrote, is about a travel piece I wrote about going to Burma with my wife. And I went to Burma because when I was hanging out with the Sun City Girls, they played me, or Alan played me, this DVD of this gathering called the Nat Puey in Burma, which is where all these transvestite spirit mediums get together. So there's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these people all in one big sort of festival, and they're doing their rituals and there's music playing all night. And I was like, and he showed me this DVD that they were putting out on their, at that point, new label, Sublime Frequencies, which remains one of my favorite labels at the moment. It just blew my mind. I was like, I have to go here. So I was like, okay, I'm going. And then I went and I wrote, you know, this piece for Strange Attractor Journal, which is a wonderful journal out of the UK about my experiences there, and it was, you know, really a mind-blowing trip. So I put those together partly to show how the dreams that are inspired by these popular culture encounters can also unfold and lead into, you know, real different experiences in your life.
That's so interesting that's what I totally didn't know that that's why you went to Burma, because it is, and to have them follow, even looking at the book, like you can see how they inform, like certain articles you write will inform other ones, and that different experiences that you have are what, it's like a trail, it's like following a trail of your consciousness, like that you can see like kind of building and things like that as you go through, you know, it's just amazing. But, yeah, I wanted to say also that I was at a lot of those shows that the Sun City Girls did because, you know, I lived in Seattle.
Oh, that's right.
And I would go to the – you talk about the clubs and describe the – and, I mean, those were places that I would go, like, every weekend. So that's, like, for me, how is uber time travel-y in a lot of your descriptions of these cultures because, like, I mean, I was present in there and, like, especially in Olympia. I went to college in Olympia and, you know, the Sun City Girls were, like, huge in Olympia because everyone was freaking out about them, especially all the art school kids. You know, they just couldn't believe it because it's coming out of, like, all this punk rock music that was popular. And then, like you said, they just, like, kind of blew everyone's minds open to something that, you know, everyone was like, what is this? And they didn't have any kind of parameters to put them into. And it, I think they inspired a lot of people, much like they did you, to just, like, open their horizons to different possibilities of how to do things like that, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Man. Yeah, that one was definitely one of my favorites. And it's funny because you mentioned how it's like a trick when they go on there and they like use, if people are doing music or writing or whatever it is, you can use these kind of tricks to break open people's minds and like slip inspiration in there in these funny ways. And I really like how you mentioned that it's like they're tricking someone into like exposing them to this material, because it reminds me of how you do that too in your writing, where, you know, you'll think that, you know, even in your Led Zeppelin book, people will think you're writing about, they'll be like, oh, it's a Led Zeppelin book, cool, like it's all about the band. But in a way, you do trick people because you stick in all of this crazy, like, esoteric occult information interwoven within the way that you write, which is very kind of witty and funny, and so you're not, like, too serious. But then you'll also, like, drop in these little seeds of, like, very deep esoteric knowledge in there, which is a little bit tricky, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, there's a quality. Again, there's a couple ways of looking at it. One is just that I'm interested in that stuff, and, you know, it's not like there's a huge world out there where you can just write, you know, esoteric articles and you know, you make ends meet. And so, in a way, it's sort of like, and also just like writing for a very small kind of consciously esoteric audience is not as interesting to me as bringing esoteric ideas into the mainstream and mainstream ideas into the esoteric, whether that esoteric is the occult or it's academia or it's, you know, intense philosophy or whatever sort of extreme world that you might be interested in. It's for me, it's about being on the margins or being on the crossroads. That's partly why there's a piece in the book on the trickster figure, on Legba or Eshu from West Africa, because for me, that figure of the trickster who's also a communicator, but you can't quite trust him, it's usually a him, that's a very powerful model for me for intellectual production, for writing in a nonfiction world, for writing in a world and engaging with media and with ideas. But there's definitely a sense, I think, in a lot of my stuff that there's a kind of subliminal infection going on, which has really been, you know, something that just always attracted me going back to college, probably, and when I first read Philip K. Dick, and I got totally into Philip K. Dick, and I wrote my senior thesis on Philip K. Dick and went on to write for the time, relatively early, mainstream articles about him in the late 80s, and because at that time he was still really a cult figure. And then there's something of that quality in his books too, particularly the later ones, where it's like he's had this crazy religious experience, and then he's writing these books, but there's a way in which he's trying to kind of spread the virus of his mystical experience through his books. And in a way, they're constructed that way. And it's not like I think that's actually happening necessarily, or at least it's not happening in those terms. But there is a sense that these, that cult books or cult bands, or that even that word we use to describe, like, particularly intense, kind of marginal, but really compulsively interesting culture heroes, that there's an aspect of that that has to do with the sense of an infection, or a transmission is probably a better word. It's a less creepy word.
Transmission is very good, yeah.
I think, like a lot of people who passionately love culture, have had, you know, dozens and dozens of things that I would call transmissions through music, through live shows, through movies or books, where, you know, my life is in some sense changed a little bit. And because I'm interested in the esoteric, those transmissions often have a slightly weird, slightly mystical, slightly conspiratorial quality to them. And so it makes sense to then turn around and kind of return the favor, as it were, and do the same kind of thing in writing, but not, again, focusing on that stuff, but just writing about things that are interesting and often not esoteric, but including that, those elements in there, almost as like little seeds that for most readers they'll just go right by, but for some they don't, and they get it. And I've had that experience. You know, I've one of the wonderful things about, you know, being a writer or writing about things you really care about, is, you know, you get a lot of feedback, and when people really like it, you're like, yeah, you get it, you know. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have, you know, their feedback's kind of like, oh, funny or wonderful, or I'm glad you turned me on to that, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, there's a certain percentage of them that are like people who sort of blows their minds. And it's like, that's such a wonderful feeling to feel like, oh, they got it. They tuned into the frequency, because it's like there's sort of more hidden frequencies in a lot of the material. And if you're ready for it, if you're up for it, it's really going to make a difference. But it's so much more classy than trying to, like, this is what's important. You
well,
should
if
be
you
paying
do that,
attention
it becomes,
to this.
It just becomes preaching, and then you're a jerk, and no one's going to want to read it anyway. But I thought it was interesting because you give an example of that kind of transmission, and it was in the Klingon article where the kind of queen of the Klingons chick was, like, suicidal, and she saw a moment in a Star Trek episode. You said it was one of the ones where Captain Kirk was, like, going off on one of his, like, what is life things, and
exactly.
Then it was through that she picked up on something which in fact saved her life. So these mystical transmissions that can be infiltrating even in something like a Star Trek episode can literally have such a powerful effect on people that it can save their lives.
Yeah, and you know, and that's I mean, I think we're still very much in that moment. I mean, when I wrote that piece about the Klingons, you know, it was the early 90s, and it was a time when people were starting to really pay a lot of attention to fan culture. People were doing it in the Academy, people were doing it inside of inside of Hollywood or whatever. Was like, wow, these fans are really intense. Like, what can we do with this? You know, and nowadays we've really kind of generalized that condition where it's like we're very much encouraged to be fans, to be interactive, to actively make meanings out of the things that we enjoy. And in fact, the system is kind of set up to do that. You know, there's a, you know, internet board where you go and you meet other people, and then people are doing the game, and da da da. And it's like every, you know, being a fan is being an active creator of media as well as a receiver, where, you know, as in the old days, it would just be like, yeah, you're just a consumer. You know, you buy the record, you buy the ticket, you watch the show, and that's it. And there was a kind of, again, looking at cult bands or cult experiences like the Grateful Dead or like Star Trek or these things that were in, earlier eras where people were intensely moved by the material, even if they were sometimes making fun of it. Like, there's a lot of humor in Star Trek fandom, but
sure,
Nonetheless, it's a kind of obsession. And then that, out of that obsession came these modes of fan culture that are now just sort of generic. It's almost like the way everybody is about the things that they love. It's very rare to find people who just like to watch stuff anymore. You know, they're sort of involved in it in a way, and that sense of involvement is is quite a transformative one, and really points to the ways that media itself has been changing. But I see now that we are at the half-hour point of our show, which is almost invariably when the lovely folks at PRN enjoy putting on some promo spots. So do you want to say that we'll be back in after these messages, Masha?
Sure,
doing the interview?
We'll be right back with Expanding Mind after a few words from Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
South of the border.
Hello, I'm Johnny Mueller, and I have a brand new show called The Expat Files, and it's all about living, working, playing, or retiring in Latin America. I know what it's like to buy land, build a house, start a business. I've been through it in a dozen Latin countries. So, if you're thinking about moving down or you're just curious, be sure to listen in Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Down Mexico way.
The Progressive Radio Network is looking to expand its programming, and we are looking for your ideas. If there's a subject that you are passionate about and we don't cover it, let us know. Give us a call at 646-307-4482 or email our program director, Carolee@GaryKnoll.com. That's Carolee@GaryKnoll.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Hello, I'm Mike Adams, the editor-in-chief and key writer of naturalnews.com and co-founder of the nonprofit site consumerwellness.org. I'll be starting a special segment on the Progressive Radio Network called The Health Ranger with Mike Adams. I'll be interviewing everyone from Dr. Jane Goodall to Suzanne Summers. Find out the latest in natural healing news and easy ways to live a healthier and more holistic lifestyle. So tune in on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern every week on the Progressive Radio Network to hear The Health Ranger with Mike Adams.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Dawu, and I'm here interviewing our host, Eric Davis, on his fantastic new book called Nomad Codes, Adventures in Modern Esoterica. And, you know, speaking of esoterica, Eric, I know we've been talking about it a little bit. One of the things that has happened with you, when you follow the trail of your consciousness, you seem to get more and more pointed towards the direction of exploring esoteric religions and esoteric culture. I mean, you know, you talk about music and, you know, all sorts of different cultural phenomenon, but it all tends to really rotate around these kind of esoteric, really religious, mystical concepts. And it's, I mean, that's a tough subject to cover, especially looking at it in popular culture and outside of any organized groups. But because it's so secretive and sort of taboo, and I mean, some people get a little upset really when you write about it, and they don't really talk about it. So you're writing about this inherently very secret occult esoteric, which is, you know, means inner hidden knowledge. What are some of the, have you come across like any big walls or difficulties in writing and exploring any of these kind of esoteric religious concepts?
Sure. You know, it's funny. At one point I was like, you know, I was doing some typical writerly complaining to my wife. You know, I was like, oh, you know, it's so hard to succeed, and oh, nobody's listening to me, and nobody's paying attention, and you know, I can't get the big deals, blah, blah, blah. And my wife's like, look, who do you admire? Who do you pay attention to? You know, Gnostic heretics, alchemists, you know, Bohemian poets. Do you really expect to be like, you know, the top New York Times bestseller list? And I was like, huh, you have a point. But more interesting than that is that whether I was writing about subcultures, which really aren't, you know, religious in any sense, or, you know, esoteric or alternative religions or even movements within, you know, more mainstream religions that interested me, you know, there's always been this kind of anthropological situation where there's kind of an underground or a hidden world, and I'm kind of an interloper moving in there, and then I'm going to say things about this world to the outside world. And it's a very difficult thing to do well, or honestly, or something like that, because you have to kind of be true to both worlds. If you just represent the way that the Klingons think of themselves, it's not going to mean anything to people on the outside, and you're not going to write the piece, or it's not going to be published. But if you just go in there, which is what most sort of average journalists do, and you just kind of make fun of the Klingons to the for the readers, just sort of supporting their existing prejudices about, oh, well, Star Trek fans are geeky and they're dorky and we can make fun of them. That's not interesting either, at least not interesting to me. And it's also not true to the experiences and the meaning that people inside those worlds get out of them, even though it's not meaning that I necessarily share. Like, I don't really care that much about Star Trek. I liked it. It was fine, you know, but I wasn't that obsessed with it. But the fact that in that case, there were these, you know, often, you know, working class people from Long Island or whatever who made their lives richer and more interesting by actively engaging this fantasy world and playing with its images in a religious way and an erotic way. And it really was clearly a net gain for their life. Well, to be able to write about that so that it's still fun and even a little bit funny, but yeah, at the same time taking it seriously enough so that they feel proud, so that they like the piece to some degree, even if they don't agree with everything you say. To me, that was always really important and also really difficult. How do you stay true to the people inside the world and true to the readers?
Well, because you're writing about these things that these people hold as sacred, I mean, for lack of a better word, even if it's something that we might think is as silly as Star Trek, I mean, like I said, these things are sacred to these people, and they are religious, and so you do take on this task of, you know, trying to present that in a certain manner, even if it's not sacred to you. I mean, it almost becomes like, you know, like someone writing about Catholicism that's not a Catholic, or even if they were a Catholic. I mean, how do you present that to popular culture?
It's very difficult. It's tough, and in fact, in some ways, I think it's a lot of ways, I think it's harder to do now than it was, for all sorts of reasons. I mean, our world has changed in so many ways, and I think that there was more room and space and interest in these alternative perspectives, whereas now, like, everybody who's interested in something alternative can just go online and find that world reflected back to them. And in some ways, there's a lot less communication across zones, because there's just the whole idea of a mass culture has fragmented into all of these multiplicitous streams where people just kind of follow their own thing. So in a lot of ways, the kind of work that I was interested in doing, in some ways, it has been sort of pushed to the side because of just the changes in the media and also just the changes of people's in people's minds. But I had an extremely illuminating and rather distressing experience a few years ago that really actually for me shifted my sense of my vocation about mm-hmm. where I could do what it was that I did well or had been trying to do well for a long time. Was I wrote a piece about Amici for Salon.
Wow.
And one of those sort of mainstream online magazines that sort of was like the print magazines that I had written for before, where they would cover politics and art, and they were pitching to a fairly generic audience in the sense that it wasn't a super targeted, but it was sort of a general audience, you know.
Right.
And I've always been fascinated by Amici stuff. I've gone. It's a trip for me. It's not something that moves me personally particularly, but I kind of love it as a theater. And I thought to myself, well, this is really interesting because, you know, here's this guru, the famous hugging guru, who's hugged
yeah.
literally millions of people. Who has this enormous empire, is extremely successful, you know, financially and in other ways, relatively scandal-free. And I'm like, well, let's try to write about it. What is it about this? What are people appealing to? So I went to, you know, out here in Castro Valley in Northern California, where you have all the Marin County people and all this stuff, and it's a huge scene. And I've been there a couple times, and so I went to, you know, to write about it, and as usual, you know, my concern was really how to represent the people there, the scene there, in a way that was authentic to it, you know, while still being able to translate it into this outside world. So I worked really hard at I talked to a lot of people. I really tried to frame it. I really made sure that I talked to Indians as well as Americans and you know, there was a guy there who had cerebral palsy, and like, what did it mean for him? And then you know, talk to her, and you know, whatever. I really did a good reporter's job of like getting multiple perspectives on it, and I worked really hard to present their worldview. And in my article, I made this argument. Because I was thinking, okay, a lot of secular people are going to be reading this, and they're going to be going, come on, this guru stuff, what's this? It's a bunch of
hugging, whatever.
Yeah, and I thought, well, no, I'm going to make an argument to these people. And my argument was the following. It was like, AMA is an NGO. AMA is an NGO that extracts money from unhappy, in many cases, lonely, seeking, bored Westerners, and extracts this money for them in exchange for an experience, for a performance, and then takes that money and whatever amount of it gets skimmed for graft or corruption or whatever, nonetheless, unquestionably builds hospitals,
That's
affordable
right.
housing, et cetera, in India. All
yeah.
of that is unquestionably true. You might quibble about the degree of corruption, but again, compared to other gurus, and certainly compared to other NGOs, it's really not that much of a problem. So that was my thinking. Hey, if I was a secular person, I would find this amusing. God, isn't that funny? You're right. It's like an NGO. Who cares, after all, what those Marin housewives do with their extra cash and their afternoons? But my God, the vitriol from the quote-unquote new atheists and assorted defenders of rationality that appeared on that board blew my mind.
Whoa.
Blew my mind. I had no idea that people could be so callous and so harsh and so vitriolic against any form of religious or spiritual culture. And it was really distressing. It really was like, hey, something has changed in our culture, in the culture of the mainstream. And it really kind of shifted my, I was like, you know, I can't really quite do what I'm used to doing in the same way. I mean, there were other things that led up to that conclusion. But I think in a lot of ways we've become, you know, a more fragmented society. There's less interest across the lines. People think of religion and they think of Islamic terrorists or of fundamentalist Christians. And that middle road, even though it's still there, it's in yoga, it's all over the place, It's a harder, at least from my perspective, it's a harder thing to pull off.
Well, do you feel like now you have to censor yourself for fear of being thought of as a kook?
Huh, that's a good question. Yeah, well, in some ways, I've always played that line where I've always wanted to be able to write about this stuff in a way that a secular person with an open mind could read and at the very least find amusing, not find themselves being pushed out or forced to make a decision about whether they think I'm a believer or not. And I always wanted to hoe that line because it seemed a very interesting place to be in, a very productive place to write about religion on, that kind of middle zone. And I don't, you know, it depends on where you're writing, it depends who for, it depends what the context is. You know, if you write for Reality Sandwich, nobody cares. If you write for New York Times Magazine, which I haven't, you know, you got to work pretty hard to keep that line. But it can happen there too. There was a very positive article about Jung's Red Book.
That's right.
A while back, which kind of surprised everybody, because usually you think of the New York Times as being a very anti-Jungian kind of place.
Well, it's
so
true, and
it's hard to know.
I mean, the state of the matter is that if you even use certain words, regardless of your own feelings, like if you even like coin the term God in certain ways, people are just going to like put all kinds of stuff on it immediately and then kind of disregard you. So you have the task in writing about this material to try and make it available for people to read without putting a bunch of stuff on it. But, I mean, you can just say the word astrology and immediately like half the people in America will put the thing down. So
yeah, that's true. Astrology,
you know,
is actually one of the hottest trigger points for
yeah.
sure. If you suggest that you take it at all seriously, that's a real quick way. You know, like even as a cultural system, it's just interesting. You know, don't peg me down. I don't think the planets are like pushing me around. You know, it doesn't matter. And part of it is that the culture of skepticism or the culture of atheism has changed significantly, you know, since the 90s or whatever, and that has really made a marker on a lot of discourse. Another example in this regard is Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
Wikipedia is great in a lot of ways. I use it for some things. It's really great and dependable. For other things, much less so.
Yeah.
And one of those other things is particularly religious, and especially alternative religious or spiritual or healing kinds of information, because the site is viciously and constantly patrolled by a kind of skeptic brigade.
That's right.
Which makes it difficult even to report what other people say about any given treatment. You know, so mm-hmm. if you don't, you can't say cranial sacral treatment affects the da 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 da. You know, no, you can't do that, obviously.
Mm.
But if you say, you know, cranial sacral treatment is reported to da 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 da, and then you give like a full account, they'll get down on that because they'll say, no, that's not possible. This is da da da. So in order to put forward good information about esoterica, about magic, about alternative healing practices, whatever, in Wikipedia is a you know, you're taking on a lot of fighting. So there's sort of it's a nastier culture to try to talk about these alternative things in some ways. But, you know, in other ways, as I said, like the success of yoga has really changed a lot of people's lives, and obviously more people are interested in healthy eating and in, you know, mind-body holistic practices. And, you know, in a lot of ways, things are still on the right track. But at least in terms of the things that I've been interested in writing about, it's a different world. Not necessarily a worse world, just a different one.
And do you feel like you have interest in reaching audiences like that? Or do you think you'll stay in the kind of niche spots? Or are you interested in just like really like, you know, like writing an article for the New York Times about something like that? Like, is that something you feel like
yeah,
you want to tackle?
That's a good question. I've actually really shifted my... When I was younger, I had a certain kind of ambition just to be heard across the board and to get people to pay attention who were, you know, secular in their outlook to, you know, interesting, weird ideas. And I'm less driven by that. I have other kinds of ambitions now. And in fact, I'm in a PhD program now, so I've really changed. I mean, in a lot of ways, I was doing sort of scholarly work through the guise of writing books and writing, you know, thoughtful articles, you know, for 20 years. And, you know, so in a way, it's a big change for me to sort of say, hey, I'm going to go into this institution, and it has its own rules and its own lamenesses and, you know, all sorts of constraints that it has as well. But I did that partly because I felt that it was a better place to deal with some of the core issues that interest me. I think that on one level, the kind of writing that I was doing in Nomad Codes is probably going to be the best sort of writing that I do in terms of just being able to enjoy it. But I was also skirting around some intellectual issues and some problems, some deeper problems that are hard to get to in the format of an essay or a review or a profile. And I was really compelled by those issues about how do we think about magic in the modern world? You know, how do we think about mystical experience in light of neuroscience? How do we appreciate and understand the roles that these alternative religions have played on modern culture in a way they've been very ignored for the most part, and now there's starting to be a lot of attention paid. And so within the academy, there's actually a lot of interesting stuff that's happening around magic, around esotericism, around mysticism. So it's actually a pretty fun time to go back to school and to be dealing with the same kind of issues that I'm used to, and in a way, talking to a different kind of audience. So in some ways, my sense of the audience has shifted, and since I keep writing articles for online and doing the radio show and stuff, I'm still have one foot in that pop world, but I don't care as much anymore. I'm more just interested in the people who find me, they find me, they don't find me, they don't find me. I'm less interested in arguing with people who have a real strong commitment to a kind of secular perspective. I mean, our world is so splintered now, it's so multiple.
Well, one of the things you're very good at, right, is taking these very scholarly concepts and ideas, and I mean, it's one of the things that I try to do too, in introducing them into pop culture and looking at what happens when these very, like, kind of, you know, scholarly, gnarly, philosophical ideas can infiltrate things like a band, like Sun City Girls, or like, you know, something like that that is this kind of very poppy thing. And so I'm just curious, like, if you feel like in doing the, I don't know if you can answer this, you might get in trouble, but in doing the PhD program, like, if you'll still continue to do, like, kind of fun, funky public lectures and stuff like that, where you'll, like, kind of go out to the general crowd instead of, like, you know, just, like, in the academic world.
Very much so. I mean, I couldn't do it if I wasn't able to keep my hand in it. And again, that's partly what I love about this radio show, is that every week I got to pay attention to some interesting thing that's going on, and while the conversations are pitched, you know, higher than your average radio show, they're also very accessible and funny and engaging. I keep writing for things, and I'm doing some public lectures in the spring, and I'm doing a workshop at Esalen, and I'm doing something at the Jung Center in Houston, and so I need to keep doing that. I'm sure there's going to be periods where, just as in writing a book, the amount of work I'm doing is going to keep the production pretty low. But in the long run, it's going to be better for what I do. And that's what, you know, so I might have to go into the mines for a few years. But on the far end of it, I think it will enable me to engage my things. And I'm always speaking to that. You know, I refuse to write in a completely academic way. I mean, I'm willing to wrestle with difficult issues. In fact, it's really fun. But
I mean, we need people like you, Eric. I mean,
I'm not abandoning you.
Because, I mean, this is what bums me out the most. And I always think of Kurt Vonnegut when he said that, like, the most difficult concept of physics, the physician should be able to explain to a 5-year-old child. And it bums me out so bad, the exclusivity that goes around with some of these, you know, very intelligent people dealing with some of these important things about our world and our lives and nature, and they make it so inaccessible that it can't penetrate the popular consciousness, and no one understands. And to be able to do that without dumbing it down, without taking out the discipline, but communicate those concepts in a way which, I mean, I feel like you do, in a way that is accessible, is truly, I think, one of the things that is going to push our consciousness as a, you know, as a race, as a species, to another level is when people will be able to share all of that knowledge in a way that is that keeps it true and keeps it able to communicate to everybody.
Well, it's funny that you say all that, because what I'm realizing as I enter into this, you know, academic process that I've been, you know, aware of, and I've dipped in, I've written pieces for academic collections, you know, for over the last couple of decades. But as I enter into it, I realize that I have the same attitude that I did towards popular writing, you know, rock reviews. You know, when I was writing rock and roll reviews for Rolling Stone and Spin magazine, I had this sense that I was on a secret mission, that I was sort of using it as a vector for these other, you know, commitments that I had. And in a way, it's the same thing. It's just that it's a different environment. It's like, it's not any more comfortable. It's not any more dominant, at least at the moment. And it's like, I'm still going to pursue this weird transition or transfer of ideas and images and hopefully transmissions. It's just that it's a different environment that has its own pluses and its own minuses. I mean, I might not be able to pull it off. It might just drive me insane, and you know, I'll jump back into the freelance gutter with the rest of them. But at the moment, there's actually quite a lot of room for another version of the same kind of stealth esoterica that I had been practicing with popular writing as well. So I don't think I can change what it is that I do that much, for better or worse.
Stealth esoterica. That's awesome. I like that idea. Is there anything you want to tell folks? I know you mentioned our event that's happening December 9th at the Besant Lodge here in Los Angeles, and then on the 7th you're going to be in San Francisco. Is there anything else you have coming up or that you want to let people know about?
Yeah, I think those are the only two points that are coming up. I just wanted to, you know, give people, if they want to get more information about those events, they can go to my website, technosis.com, and you're going to get some of the details on those readings, and just keeping up with the radio show. I think we have next week, I'm not sure what we're doing, but the following week we have KMO, and we're going to be talking about zombies, so that should be pretty good.
Yeah.
That's about it for now. How about you? Are you doing any lectures?
I am. I'm doing I'm wrapping up my series on the 12th at the Besant Lodge, too. It's going to be on math and God, which is always fun.
Math? You mean like mathematics?
Yeah, like mathematics.
Wow. That's going to draw the serious esoteric geeks out.
I hope so. Sometimes geeks come out, man. Sometimes I'll have engineers. Like, I got these two guys that work, I won't mention their names, but they work at JPL, and they make bombs. And they come
to
my lectures on esoterica.
That's so funny you mentioned JPL, because right now for one of my classes, and it's actually going to be in a book about modernity and magic, I'm writing about Jack Parsons and the whole, you know, the crossover of Crowley and magic and the development of JPL and rocketry. So I
know, but these guys don't know anything about, you know, JPL or any of that stuff, but yet they'll come to my lectures, which I think is, like, amazing, right? So, that, like, ironically enough, that kind of stuff is still infiltrating his institution, right?
Isn't that weird?
Well, it's so weird.
Southern California is so weird. I think that's actually probably true everywhere, especially, you know, In any engineering world, really in any world at all, you dig around, you're going to find people with esoteric interests. I mean, not any world, but most worlds.
It's true. I'm sure you see that at talks you give. I mean, there's literally, like, people will show up from all walks of life. I love seeing the different people that come in that are into this stuff. I mean, it's literally, there will be doctors, there will be bums. I mean, it runs the spectrum.
Yeah, well, that's one of the fun things about it. It's like it's a secret world, and so therefore it does not have that. You don't know where it exists. You don't know the ends of it. You don't know how far it goes. And you start talking with people, and you don't know, are they crazy? Are they initiated in some secret organization? Do they just read a lot of weird books? And you don't know. And that sense of mystery, if you can keep it playful, is really one of the most appealing flavors in my experience of the world. And I think it's a wonderful way to be in the world and to communicate with people and to have a sense of that there's another dimension, which may be just a game that we're all playing, but if it is a game, it's a serious game, or it's a game that has its own possibilities and potentials in it. And that's what I was trying to do with Nomad Codes, and I hope people check it out. And I want to thank you, Maja, for interviewing me. And folks, please tune in weekly here on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your minds open.